Today's topic reminded me of a quote that my dad gave me. My dad's always given me books and quotes, and I have a whole file of things from my dad. But this one I didn't need to write down or memorize. It just stuck with me. It was, "You love your kids by loving their father. You love your kids by loving their mother." And it just really makes you stop and think about the huge impact your relationship with your spouse has on your kids. And that's what we're going to be talking about this morning. And I know I tend toward unhealthy things like holding bitterness and giving the silent treatment very effectively. And that quote stops me in my tracks pretty good. Think, am I going to model this for my kids? So this is how you treat your spouse. So Lee and Debbie Campbell are here today to talk about this and give us some of their insights. Lee is a counselor on staff here at Xenos, and they have two kids, 11 and 17, and they've been home church leaders since time began, he told me. So about 26 years. So they've got a lot of good experience to share with us this morning. And I was thinking, you know, we all do the New Year's resolutions. We all want to lose weight. That's always on there. But maybe after today, we can think about putting something on there that has to do with strengthening our marriage, a New Year's resolution about that. So let's bring them up and hear what they have to say.
Come on up. I'm the content guy, so I'm going to go through some content. This is Debbie. She's going to be the reality check girl. She's going to say things like, okay, that's not really how it works. That's not really how we are. And that'll be really good. But so she'll be super helpful during the Q&A time. I'm Lee. This is Debbie. We've been married 26 years. We've known each other 27 years. Got two kids. We're not perfect. We're survivors. and in some senses, we're thrivers. And so maybe we can share what we've learned. And I'm going to go ahead and get started, and Debbie will join me after. The single most important parenting tip anyone could offer is to have a good marriage. Study after study shows that kids from healthy marriages live longer, they're healthier, they're more successful. They're less likely to be abused. There's a lot of things that contribute to the health of a child, but one of the primary things that contributes to the health of a child is a healthy marriage. Now, I am not saying that only kids from healthy marriages can be healthy, right? Some of you aren't in that situation. You've gone through a divorce or there's been a death and you're a single parent. I'm not saying that all kids from healthy marriages turn out great. Sometimes we wonder about ours, whether our son's going to turn out great now that he's 17 and thinks he knows everything. And so we're not a perfect couple. We don't have a perfect marriage. We don't have perfect children. But I think the principles I want to talk about today are principles that are valuable not only for enhancing marriage, but frankly, they're valuable for enhancing any relationship. And if you find yourself in a situation where you are a single parent, I would just say, take these principles and use them to forge good friendships, because that's going to do a lot to help you in your parenting as well. So, marriage is complex, but I thought it might be helpful to simplify things. I developed this material for a men's study group, and men are very simple. And, you might think, four principles? Really, the four principles? Why not 17 principles? Why not, 21 principles? There's a lot of marriage books, and there's lots of principles, but I find I don't remember them very well because I'm a simple person, and I need simple things. I need a simple thing in my head that helps me to understand. And so these are the four principles I'd like to talk about today, and then you have a handout. If you haven't picked it up, they're back on the table there. I'd go ahead and grab one. The four principles are that the marriage is, or the friendship is, Christ-centered. Talk about what that means in a second. That it involves delighting in one another. That it involves faithfully loving one another. And I put that in italics because this is a translation of a Hebrew word, hased. This is how God is toward us. He faithfully loves us. and this is part of our involvement with one another, is that we express this chesed toward one another, this faithful love. So I want to talk about that. And lastly, being intimate with one another. And in our day and age, the word intimate has become synonymous with sex, and that's not what I'm talking about. I'm using intimate in its old-fashioned sense of knowing someone and being known to them. Where's sex? Sex is in every single one of these four principles. So you can practice these principles with people that you're friends with and not be sexual with them. And it's great. It'll make for a great relationship. But sexuality is tied up in each of these. And so we'll come back in the end. We'll take a quick look at sexuality and how it's related to these. And if you want more sex, there's a three-week course that Bev DeLashmit and I are offering January 19th and the sequential two Wednesdays after that on married sex. Sorry for the double meaning. It wasn't accidental, but sorry for it. Now, here's an image that I find useful, and again, maybe with guys. It's just a little tetrahedron. A tetrahedron is a triangular pyramid, and you notice there are four sides. When I first started sort of unpacking these principles, I took paper and folded it into a tetrahedron, and I wrote each of these principles on each side. It's in my nightstand next to my bed, and I pull it out every once in a while, and I haven't been doing that. And so I just have a twirling tetrahedron in my head, and I think about this a lot. Let's look at each of these. What does it mean to have a Christ-centered marriage? You know, in ancient people, married in order to become secure and to have status in culture. That's primarily why people were driven to marry. Modern people marry for happiness. The Bible treats both of these views as naive. You know, we don't marry for status or security. We don't marry for happiness. The purpose of marriage is for two to increasingly become one. And this is a key insight into marriage that I think is easy to lose. I think in some senses it's easier for men to lose than women. There is me, there is my spouse, and there's this third thing called us. And it's this loyalty to us. It's this building of the us that is so critical in a healthy marriage. And so the biblical view is that two people increasingly become one. And way back in the book of Genesis, this is brought up, and it's hard to tell from translations, but the text, the Hebrew text in Genesis literally reads that the two will be becoming one. It's a process. It's an ongoing thing. And this is the purpose of marriage. The primary purpose of marriage, whether I look at Genesis or the Song of Solomon or the New Testament, is not to produce children. It is an effective marriage. It can be an effective marriage. But the interesting thing is that in Genesis 2, where marriage is talked about, children aren't. The primary focus is the relationship. In Song of Songs, there's no discussion of children at all, which is really odd for an ancient Near Eastern culture like this. And in the New Testament, there is no mention of children at all when marriage is talked about, other than parenting children. But when marriage itself is talked about, what's discussed is the marriage itself. There's something about this, the purpose, the primary purpose of marriage is for two to become one. In a sense, you know, whenever God wants to talk about himself and the way he feels about us, the analogy that he seizes on is marriage. He says that he wants to be one with us. The same language that's used of marriage. The last night that Jesus was on earth, his prayers were, Father, I want them to be one as you and I are one. I want them to be one with us, I in them and they in us, that they may be brought to perfect unity, that they may have the glory that you and I had from the beginning, that they may be one as we are one. Interesting. This is a high value. There's a sense in which marriage done even halfway well is a foreshadowing of a permanent love relationship with God. Well, modern people often marry because they see something wonderful in the other person. You probably saw something wonderful in your spouse when you married them. Afterward, you realize this wonderful quality was much more embryonic than they thought. Or was more attached to that person's self-centered goals. You know, he's so attentive. And then you get married and you realize, because he wanted me. right? She's so sensitive because she wanted to impress him. And now that the commitment has been made, the motivation is gone, and now you're like, what happened to you? You changed. No, it's the same selfish person you married, just like you are. Modern people have sort of a consumer mentality because we're looking for happiness. That's the primary motivation for marriage often. And so we often say, I will be the spouse I ought to be to the degree that you're the spouse that you ought to be. In other words, if you make me happy, I'll reciprocate. Well, this is quid pro quo, isn't it? It's a Latin expression which means what for what? Give to get. And I've never had a couple come into counseling where any one of the spouses has said, you know, my spouse may have some problems, but I'm primarily here because I am all messed up. One of the toughest jobs of a counselor is to get each member of that couple to attend to their own issues. That's a hard job. And it's primarily what actually caused the rift to begin with, an inability to attend to your own issues. We're all full of self-focus and self-trust, right? We've got our techniques. We've got the things we've developed from our youth, and we're very focused on ourselves. Well, fortunately, God has an answer for these problems of self-focus and self-trust, and it gets to this issue of Christ-centeredness. The primary issue that I find as a husband in my marriage is that I'm self-righteous. If you want to read a great secular book on this topic, read the book, Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. Social psychologists have done a great job of taking a look at what they've determined is a primary human tendency to justify self and to be self-deceived. It's a primary human tendency. And even the authors of the book, one of them did sort of a famous experiment where they set up a guard-prisoner situation, and it got way out of hand, and they admitted it took them years to admit they'd screwed up. They had so much trouble seeing that they erred, and they had so many justifications, and they point out in their experiments that people within milliseconds have a story to tell to explain away the thing they did that doesn't match how they view themselves. If people with higher self-esteem are more likely to be self-deceived than people with lower self-esteem. Because when you mess up and you have high self-esteem, there's a sense of, I'm a pretty good person. I'm a pretty good person. And yet you've done this horrible thing. And so you immediately have to have an explanation for why you did this horrible thing. And it turns out it's them. Or it turns out you didn't mean what you said. Or it turns out they don't understand you. Or it turns out, and this is just a human tendency. And this, in fact, is the interesting thing about this book is when they come to the very end of the whole story and that you ask the question, what do you do about this tendency to be self-justified and self-deceived? Their answer is something like repentance, humility. Well, this is really, I think, frankly, hard to do. Maybe you're not a Christian here, and this first principle seems a little off. But I, frankly, am having trouble understanding how you could be motivated to attend to the marriage other than just basic compatibility, which you had nothing to do with. I think you can have a great marriage and not have it be Christ-centered if you're basically compatible. But if you've gotten together and you realize, okay, we have some compatibility, but there's a lot of problems, a lot of differences, I'm not sure how you handle this. So what I mean by Christ-centered then is that you have to sort of realize at a core level, and this really gets to how you view yourself, I'm a big fat sinner. I am self-centered, and I have techniques for getting what I want. The more deeply you understand this, the more deeply you understand your need for Christ. And the more quickly you move toward him. There's a great book on this. I think it's in your notes that I think is focused on this issue of Christ-centeredness. Every marriage book has a focus. And the one that I think is really a Christ-centered focus is this book entitled When Sinners Say I Do. And he spends many chapters trying to point out that the biggest problem in your marriage is you. And I would say the same thing to your spouse. The biggest problem in your marriage is you. And frankly, the only thing you can change is you, so you might as well just pay attention to that point. So it'd be focusing on your own fault. This is part of what it is to realize, you know, when my wife and I are in conflict, I immediately and seamlessly start defending myself, justifying myself, and explaining myself. I came home from the store last night, with groceries, because I was pretty sure that I had said yesterday, hey, we need this and this, should I get groceries? And I was pretty sure my wife said, yes, you should. And I got home, and I'd forgotten. I went to the game. I left the game early. I went to the store. I brought groceries home. I'm home. I'm putting away groceries, realizing she bought groceries too. She is really sure that she said, when I get done with work tomorrow, I'm going to go to the store and bring home groceries. And so we spent time this morning explaining to one another how it was... Obviously, she said, I wouldn't have gone to the store and gotten groceries if I thought you were supposed to get them. And I said, well, obviously, I wouldn't have gone to the store and gotten groceries if I knew you were supposed to get them. And so, but there's a point at which I thought, how could I possibly know? I'm pretty sure I was supposed to. She's pretty sure she was supposed to. I'm just going to do a mental timeout and say, we've got extra groceries. But, you know, a lot of our fights that are less about functional things are like this, where we're instantly on the muscle, we're instantly defending, we're instantly explaining, we're instantly justifying. And there's a point at which my wife and I, and sometimes I have to ask for a timeout so I can do it, which is not an effort to escape from the relationship, but an effort to clear my mind so I can focus on my own issues, I'll sometimes take a time out and I'll be like, okay, what did you do wrong? And usually it'll seem like some small thing. And so I'll admit that small thing. And as I'm admitting it, it enlarges. It's like one of those little sponges you stick in water. It just gets bigger and bigger and you realize, oh, okay, it was mostly me. But the cool thing is often, simultaneously, she's thinking it was mostly me. And this is a great thing to do. Focusing on your own fault, not making excuses. You know, if you struggle with anger, if you struggle with anxiety, you need to have this committed view of yourself. That my spouse didn't cause me to be angry. My spouse didn't make me anxious. Their behavior provided the occasion for my heart to express itself. Your heart has some sort of a commitment that your spouse threatens or blocks. So they created the occasion for your anger or anxiety. They didn't create your anger or anxiety. And so you need to admit, you know, focus on your fault, not make excuses. But I think, you know, part of this too is believing that you have a great Savior. It's not enough to feel like you're a great sinner. All you're going to feel is morose. You have to realize that you also have a great Savior. The people who cannot admit fault are the people who have no other option in their mind other than to be right, that which is, by the way, called self-righteousness. But those who feel like they do have an option besides being right realize that this option is to go to God and be forgiven. And the more deeply you understand the forgiveness that is available in Christ, the more free you are to admit how messed up you are. You know, this remorse and regret, I think I've got a little quote here from Keller, are part of what he says is the self-salvation project. I was talking with a guy recently who was very tearful. Lately he's been super tearful. When he talks about his role as a husband and a father, and I've asked him, are you tearful because you're grateful, or are you tearful because you feel shame? And he said, a little bit of both. And so I quoted this to him: remorse and regret are part of the self-salvation project, meaning to be disappointed in yourself is to have trusted yourself, and part of understanding you're a great sinner is to realize that you're not that trustworthy, but you know someone who is. And also, I think realizing that you can depend on a great lover. You know, God is a great lover. And I couldn't, frankly, my wife and I are basically compatible. We both come from sort of a blue-collar background. We both like to laugh. We both like a lot of the same things, not exactly the same things. There's a lot of things about us that are basically compatible. But truthfully, many times in our relationship, and I'm sure we both feel this way, the view you have of the other person is that they are a threat to you, that they're taking something from you. For me, who's more laid back, who really loves peace and quiet, it's a big value for me. My wife's really a threat to this hunger for peace and quiet, because when I come home from work, her mind is full of things that she wants to share with me. And as she's sharing all of these things, inside my intestines start going, and I start getting all knotted up, and I'm like, oh, man, the peace and quiet I was yearning for is not here right now. And, you know, early on in our relationship, I was terrible at responding to this. As time's gone on, I feel like I want to show up. I want to be the guy that she can unpack her day with. And I love the fact that she brings things up with me that get me moving, because typically I'm not a goal-oriented guy. I'm oriented toward ideas, but not so much for practical goals. And she, even though I find it super agitating and I hate it, I'm like, oh, in my heart. You know, outside, I'm like, yeah, that's good. But inside, I'm like, you know, dying. I realize that she is not supposed to meet all of my needs and demands. God alone can take care of my needs and demands. I want rest. Jesus said, I'll give you rest. I want pleasure. The Psalms say that there are eternal pleasures at God's right hand. He may give me pleasure and rest through my wife, but it's not her job to play that role. He may choose to give me pleasure and rest in other ways. He may choose to give me peace and quiet at other times. It's his call. He gets to decide. And because I believe he's a great lover, I feel like I can wait for him to give me what I feel like I really need and crave. And when I feel like I'm full, and this doesn't, of course, doesn't happen all the time. In fact, it happens perfectly, very, very rarely. But even if it's happening partially, and I really believe that my deepest needs are going to be met by God, I am able then to be a good lover. Because I'm not in a relationship trying to avoid being taken from, or in a relationship trying to take something from. I'm in a relationship to give, knowing that I can be perfectly supplied by God when and how he wishes. I can wait for him. This is why Christ-centeredness is so critically important. And there's so much to say about each of these, but I really need to roll through. So I'm going to focus on this next thing, and that's delighting in them. The most enjoyable part of any relationship is the sense that you're appreciated and enjoyed. So one of the greatest and rarest gifts we can give is our enthusiasm and appreciation. You want to read a great book? This is my recommended book for this topic. My recommended book for the first topic is When Sinners Say I Do. My recommended book for this topic is The Song of Solomon. It's all about delight. And delight being expressed in a variety of ways. One thing that you're going to discover is that as you express delight, you actually feel more delight. There are times in any relationship, and maybe even long stretches, where your feeling toward your spouse is sort of like, eh. You know, you're roommates. You're, for all intents and purposes, you might as well be a brother and a sister. You're in the same house. You're having discussions about functional tasks. Especially when kids are young, you both, you know, go through the day and collapse and you're tired. And there's these stretches of time where there's very little sense of who are you? I really enjoy you. And let me just tell you my favorite technique for dealing with my problem. Remember, you have to focus on you. A lot of you are looking at this going, oh, if only they delighted in me. No. You're seeing this all backward. You have to delight in them, even if you get nothing back, because you belong to a great lover who will take care of that need for you to be delighted in. Well, anyway, one of my favorite techniques is to write my wife a note, a love letter. And there have been so many times when I've sat down to write a note or a love letter, and I've thought, okay, what do I like about her? I'm coming up empty. You know, well, I love her laugh. So, you know, I'll write something about her laugh. And well, there's things I like about her physically, but I won't go there. Or, you know, I like her commitment to God. I like the fact that she gets more done by 9 o'clock than most people do all day. I like the fact that she can be very playful, but I like the fact she can get so much done at the same time. I like her commitment to God. And so I'm writing. And as I'm writing, I'm starting to feel really hot for my wife. I'm like, I got to go find this person that I couldn't even feel anything for a few seconds ago. What changed? Did she change? No, she wasn't even there. I changed. How did I change? I focused on what was good about her. So delighting in someone is not only good for them, it's actually good for you. Delighting in someone enhances your own experience of joy. And it helps them as well. Some of you are more effusive than others. Just in temperament and personality, you're just more effusive or you're less effusive. But everyone can direct positive attention toward their spouse. Everyone can. Well, one thing that I was thinking of here was just praising. Praising is appreciating someone for who they are. And so part of what I was doing as I was writing this love letter was really just praising her. Things I like about her, physically, spiritually, intellectually, functionally, things I really enjoy about her. Praise takes reflection. This is really not something you typically could do on the fly. You have to stop and think. What do I like about them? What are their positive physical, emotional, intellectual, social, spiritual attributes? What do I depend on? What do I deeply appreciate? What are their gifts? What are they burdened for? Maybe they're what they're gifted and burdened for you've been looking at negatively, but look at it the other way around. What is good about that gifting? What's good about that burden that they have? Maybe that gifting and burden is a threat to you, but set aside that it feels like a threat and a drain to you and think about what's cool about it. And then, I guess, express it. You know, praise in your heart will help you a little bit, but praise expressed toward them will help them. Tell them face to face. Tell them in a note. Tell them on a plane. Tell them on a boat. Tell others in their presence. Tell others in their absence. Frankly, there's a bigger thing going on here than just your marriage. There's a community effect. You know, I have heard a lot of women say to me that they hate getting together with their girlfriends because all they do is complain about their husbands. Well, that's an ethos. You're creating an ethic and a view of critique toward your spouse, and that is not going to help you. And it's certainly not going to help your spouse. How about you creating an environment and an ethic of affirmation? How about that? The same thing can happen with guys, by the way. Get together and complain about their wives. How about you be the one that steps up and says, I love my wife. I really like this quality. I really like that. You could tell them non-verbally as well. Not just verbally, but non-verbally. You know, when I got in the truck the other day and I'm driving my daughter to school and my wife's out walking the dog and I see her and I said, let's go say hi to mom. So I drive up and I roll down the window and I said, hey lady, I see you're walking your dog. You know, and she just burst out laughing and I just, you know, I didn't have to say, oh, I love your laugh. I think she could tell by the look on my face. I totally love your laugh. I totally love you. Right? You can do it non-verbally as well. Maybe you couldn't. Could you tell? Thanks has to do with appreciating what they've done. They're both issues of gratitude, but one is appreciating someone for who they are intrinsically. The other is appreciating someone for what they've done. All the things I could say about praise, I could say about thanks. It takes reflection, and it needs to be expressed. And then also, I don't know how to frame this. Oh, man. Something's going on here. Oh, well. I don't know quite how to frame this. I guess cherishing is a lot like praising and thanking. But it's sort of just in general, apart from specific feedback, just letting them know you appreciate them, expressing enthusiasm, expressing interest, expressing desire when you're alone or whether you're in a group, and you can do that by body language. You know, if your spouse is talking and you're sort of turned around looking elsewhere, that says something. If your spouse is talking and you're looking and you're smiling and enjoying them, that says something as well. Body language, playfulness. This is frankly one, I think probably on my deathbed, I will reflect on the most enjoyable part of my marriage is how playful we are together. How fun it is to be with her. You know, we're just playful, being playful. Alert to them. You know, I am just sort of a little bit more naturally this way, maybe more naturally than my wife. I'm not sure if she would feel the same way, but I feel like when she's in the room, I'm watching her. I'm noticing her demeanor. I'm noticing her body language. I'm noticing the things she's saying. I'm just alert to and curious what's going on with you. And I think that would be a gift, really, you could give your spouse. Being enthusiastic about them moving toward you. You know, if they move toward you, you could be really flat and go, "Ah, I see you're moving toward me." Or you could be excited about it. Expressing enthusiasm and desire when you're apart as well. In the Song of Songs, the lovers are together. I really recommend reading this. And they're very enthusiastic about one another, and the lovers are apart, and they're anxious about being apart from one another, and they're expressing a desire to be with one another while they're apart. I've heard of some guys going off on business trips, and it doesn't even cross their mind to call their wife. You know, it's like out of sight, out of mind. Also, tailoring an affection in a way that's meaningful toward them. Now, if you haven't read this book, Gary Chapman's The Five Love Languages, I would recommend it with a warning. The tone of the book, I think, is basically good, but there's this undercurrent that flows through it that is quid pro quo. If I communicate with you in your love language, you need to communicate back with me in mine. And so I was talking with someone one day about, you know, you're really disrespectful to your husband in public. It's kind of gross. Well, I tried being respectful, but it didn't work. I said, "What do you mean it didn't work? He's not loving me." That's giving to get. Right? She wanted something from him. She was willing to play along with this other thing until she could see whether she was going to get what she, as good as she gave, and it didn't work out. But that's not how you are a great lover. A great lover is you identifying what would, you know, for me, I like to be touched, you know. Getting gifts, not such a big deal. Words of affirmation, kind of okay, kind of nice. You know, there's just different ways that I experience this person loves me, and she has different ways that she experiences. Basically, whatever this, the way it is that when someone expresses themselves to you in a particular way and you really feel loved, the tendency is to use that same approach with everyone else. If you like getting gifts, you just give gifts. Well, you know, a good chunk of the people you're giving gifts to just really aren't affected by gifts the way you are. If you love verbal affirmation and you're just, you know, spewing verbal affirmation everywhere, not everyone really is that moved by verbal affirmation. The idea of this tailoring your affection in a way that they can hear is that you try to figure out how they receive, how they feel loved, and express it in that way. Not to get something back, but because it's, you want to make sure that they feel cherished. All right. You know, for my wife, I think probably, what would you say? Not physical touch. Gifts a little bit. Primarily, spending time together is like her big thing. And if we're going to go on a date, the thing that I think means a lot to her is if we do something unique, because her personality loves unique experiences, together, then she feels loved. right? So that can be challenging because, you know, we also have to figure out inexpensive, unique things to do. You can find all sorts of unique things to do with money, but we have to find inexpensive, unique things together. And probably this has been the biggest failing in this part of this principle. The biggest failure for me is not spending enough time trying to come up with good ideas so that she feels like she's got to come up with the good idea. Sorry. Yeah. Also, then, faithfully loving them. I already said this faithful love is in italics because it's a translation of a Hebrew word, chesed. It is said of God. God says, I am full of chesed toward you. I am full of faithful love. I forgive. I extend mercy. I'm going to define faithful love in a particular way. I guess some people might define this as commitment, but commitment could mean nothing more than the passive experience of not leaving. And I mean more than not leaving. I mean something that is working for the good of your spouse, regardless of who they are, in spite of who they are, for their good. God's love is not just unconditional. It's better than unconditional. It's contra-conditional. He loves us in spite of who we are, knowing who we are, with the intent to see us grow. And this is really part of faithfully loving. So faithfully loving them, in a sense, does include commitment, because Genesis talks about in a marriage relationship, a key part of marriage is leaving and cleaving. And it's interesting, the tense of these, both of these terms is continual. So when I chose to marry my wife, I left my family as my primary relationship. I didn't abandon my family of origin, but they are not my primary relationship anymore. And in the culture that this was written in, it was unheard of for a man to leave his home. He stayed with his family continuously. But here in Genesis, we see, no, he is to leave his home. They're to forge a relationship that's independent of and primary against any other relationship. And so leaving is this, really it's initial, but it's also an ongoing turning away from competing relationships, including with your own children. When we've had our first son, well, our only son, our first child, we were getting out of the hospital. My wife wanted to drive, and she wanted me to sit in the back seat and put the boy in the front seat. And I said, this just isn't going to happen. You know, there's such a bond that happens between mother and child that it becomes often becomes the primary relationship to the detriment of the child, oddly enough. Because a healthy marriage should be the primary relationship that is really the best way to love your child. And so this, you know, this leaving would involve turning away from flirtations, turning away from fantasies, turning away from pornography, turning to this ongoing decision. No, we are more important than me. We are more important even than my own child. I know a sex therapist who has this approach he takes with clients because he realizes, a secular guy, but he realizes the big problem he deals with in sex problems is two people focusing on themselves. And so he calls us his client. And so when one spouse starts talking against the other spouse, he says, I'm sorry, I have to protect my client. It's this other chair in the room that's empty. It's the us chair. And I think he deeply understands this basic commitment that a couple has to make, not to themselves, but to one another as a couple. And so leaving is that. Cleaving, it sounds like something you do with something sharp with a piece of meat. You know, cleave it. You cut it in half, but this term actually means to cling to attach to. And so cleaving is also in the same tense. This is you know how when you fight, one of you usually leaves? Cleaving means that you are leaving and you turn back around and move back toward. Even in your own heart, the tendency to withdraw and set yourself apart. In a book on a divorce called Uncoupling, the author of this book says that divorce begins with a secret. when one spouse or the other is dissatisfied with the other and they create in their own mind a space that their spouse doesn't know about, an independence, a private place that they cannot get at, private thoughts, private time. And it's into this space which begins to enlarge that all sorts of other things come. You know, infidelity doesn't just happen. Infidelity walks into a room that's already been created for it. This tendency to turn away, to be disappointed and bitter, and to create a separate self, a self that's separate from your spouse, is the beginning, can be the beginning of the end. And so this commitment, no, I have a great lover in God, and I'm going to turn back toward this painful situation. I'm not going to turn away. So faithful love is that you're continually leaving, continually cleaving, but also helping them succeed. God helps us succeed. And this is where I really see a difference in the Bible between the advice to husbands and the advice to wives is different. The advice that is given to husbands in Ephesians 5 is that husbands are supposed to recreate the gospel in their wife's life. They're supposed to give themselves up for her sake to present her spotless and blameless before the day of the Lord, just like Christ did the church. And so part of me helping my wife succeed, and I frankly haven't thought as deeply about this as I have over the last year even, and we've been married a long time, is that I've started thinking, okay, what are her gifts? What are her burdens? What are the personal roadblocks in her own character that are keeping her from realizing her gifts and her burdens? What's keeping her from good relationships? What does she need to attend to in order to become a better and better Debbie? And that's really my commitment as a husband, is my commitment to lay aside Lee for the sake of her. So this may mean I'd lose peace and quiet, for instance. Maybe I'm going to move toward her in a way that's going to make her uncomfortable, and she's going to make me uncomfortable to pay. I mean, that's not the way it's worked, but maybe she could, depending on how big the roadblocks are and how committed she is to them. So this is how I do it. Husbands help their wives succeed by serving them. The Bible sort of unfolds that this service is for their sake. A lot of husbands will raise tension in the marriage when they feel ripped off. This is raising tension in the relationship when you feel like she needs help. She needs help overcoming a difficulty in her character, her personality. And this means not just raising tension, but it also means providing support, service, making a space for her to succeed, offering suggestions, trying to help. My wife is very burdened toward internationals, and particularly burdened toward international Muslims, and particularly burdened for African international Muslims, and I'm not. Part of me helping her succeed is being interested in what she's doing. Part of me helping her succeed is praying for what she's involved with. And part of me helping her succeed is going into an environment where she's working and being a big brother to a kid. My primary focus isn't this, but I want to help her succeed at this. I talk her up to other people who have similar burdens or people who are willing to pray for her. I want her to succeed. If I feel like in her character there's a problem that's keeping her from success, then I want to address that with her. For wives, and I don't have as much to say about this because I don't, thank God, I don't think about what my wife needs to be doing toward me. So I don't know what to say about this, but biblically, wives help their husbands succeed by respecting them. There's a book out called Love and Respect, and this guy, again, lays it out almost like Chapman, that it's quid pro quo, that if you give your husband respect, he'll give you back love. If you give your wife love, she'll give you back respect. I don't really see it that way, but I really do believe in this survey that was done where men were asked, if you had to decide, men and women were asked, if you had to live with just one thing for the rest of your life, you would only be experience love but no respect, or for the rest of your life you would only experience respect but no love, which would you choose? And almost all men choose, I would choose to live without love so that I could have respect. I think, built into not all men. These are bell curves that overlap. But I think for a lot of men, the primary driver is to make a difference in the world. And respect is the coin that demonstrates whether I'm doing well or not. And I think a way for a wife to express, help her husband succeed is to be responsive to him, which is one way that you express respect, and just to directly respect. And I don't know, have much more to say about that, other than when my wife asks me a question, asks my opinion on something, it makes a big difference in my own heart. So maybe Debbie can say more about this. Being intimate with them means that you're honest. I'm going to cut this really short because I'm going probably too long. Intimacy means to know someone and to be known by someone. This is its traditional meaning. You can't be known if you're not telling the truth. You may not be conscious that you're lying, and you may not be lying, but frequently we have impressions and feelings that we just don't share. That hurt my feelings, but we don't say it hurt my feelings. I'm not agreeing with you, but we don't say I'm not agreeing with you. I don't see it that way, but we don't say. And part of, and I think I probably struggle with this. I let things go in my head, and then I go off and sort of noodle on them for a while. And I may or may not say something, depending on how expensive it'll be for me to say it. But what I've learned from one particular friend of mine is the beauty of just taking my cards and turning them around. The importance of just saying what I'm thinking before I have a fully developed thought. Because I think I feel like what I need to do is have a 5-point outline and have it all prepared and go and deliver it like a presentation. And I sure wouldn't want to let someone deal with the raw data of my thoughts and impressions. I don't want them to have control over it. I think that's probably what's going on, but I'm trying to be more and more honest. And honesty about your sin as well, which a self-righteous person has a lot of trouble doing. I failed. I let us down. I am sorry. You're right. I shouldn't have. Honesty about your failures. Honesty about your thoughts. But curiosity as well. There's so much to say here, and this is so little time to say it. Curiosity means that you're asking, you're noticing. A lot of people pretend to be curious because they have this hammer in their hand and they're like, oh, tell me more. Come a little closer and tell me more about that because I've got an axe to grind with you. This is genuine honesty, genuine curiosity. You just want to understand. So you ask questions that are open, not yes and no questions, but open-ended questions. How did you feel about that? And listening. Listening is not asking questions. Listening is trying to get a sense of what do they mean, what was going on. And so a part of being curious is you have to provide, not just listen, but provide feedback. Feedback doesn't mean you air out your opinion or you fix the problem. A lot of times when we see someone in distress, we pull up our tool belt and we snap it on and we start grabbing hammers and screwdrivers because we want to fix it. That's not listening. That's not being curious. Typically, our spouse knows how to solve their problem. How they're feeling is the problem. And you can't solve that by coming up with practical solutions. You solve that by listening and being interested. And so there's more to say about this. I would think that a good book to read on this is Seeing with New Eyes. Seeing with New Eyes by David Paulison. It's a really good book on this topic. What about sex? Sex is not needed to practice these four principles. These principles apply in any relationship. But in marriage, it's profoundly connected with each of them. I'm just going to say, run through this very quickly. Sex is designed primarily, biblically, I'll just say this, sex is designed to create oneness, to deepen oneness, and to celebrate oneness. To create, deepen, and celebrate oneness. But it pops up in all four of these areas, Christ-centeredness. I mean, where would you more need forgiveness? Where would you more need to admit fear? Where would you more need to admit fault? than in your sexuality? And where would you more need help from God than in this most intimate area? Especially if you've experienced abuse, especially if you've been an abuser, especially if you have been promiscuous in some way. It's distorted the purpose of sex, right? It hasn't ruined it forever, but it's distorted it. And you need a great Savior to help you think this through and to get back to beauty and health in this area. Christ-centeredness is very important. And oddly enough, I know this sounds a little weird and creepy, but in the letter that Paul wrote to Corinthians, he's talking about guys who have sex with prostitutes. And he says, do you realize you're joining Christ to her? That because I'm in Christ and Christ is in me, this is expressed negatively. I mean, my wife's not a prostitute. That's a negative expression. But the positive principle here is that because Christ is in me and in her, when we come together sexually, he is with us. I'll just tell, I'll reveal something about my wife. Sometimes she prays during sex because she gets mentally distracted. And so she prays. I'm cool with that because I want her to be fully present, and Christ is able to help. Right? Sorry. That's, you probably embarrassed the hell out of you, didn't I? I'm sorry. All right. Delighting then. There's nothing more obvious when you read through Song of Songs than the delight that's tied up in sexuality. And I listed all this stuff for you just because I wanted you to see it all. And for one thing, and Adam, when he first saw Eve, one translator put it this way. When Adam saw Eve, he was like, wow, I'm finally complete. There's evidence in the text itself that when they first came together sexually, God was there. They were naked and they were unashamed. God was present in their coupling. But also in Song of Songs, we see a huge expansion of sexual delight because they're kissing, they're touching, they're cradling, embracing, they're hugging, they're visually flirting with each other, they're fondling each other, they're sexually turning each other on, they're having intercourse, they're smelling, they're mouthing, they're licking, they're tasting, they're watching. They're delighting in one another. And I think it's worth reading the Song of Songs just to get a sense of, you know, what delight looks like sexually. Nothing. There's no place where you can express deeper delight than in sex. You can express delight in a lot of ways, but sexually, that's a way to do it. And frankly, it's a way also where your delight in your spouse increases. Well, at least I hope so. Faithfully loving them. Nothing says it better. Two become one. This is really part of sexuality. It creates, celebrates, and deepens oneness. Some people might ask. In the letter to Corinthians, Paul says, you know, to wives, your body doesn't belong to you, it belongs to your husband. You're like, wait a minute, but it says the opposite as well. Husbands, your body doesn't belong to you, it belongs to your wife. Don't keep denying each other. Paul understands this sense that there's an entity apart from the individuals once you're married and that you belong to one another physically. And so I've had a lot of growing up to do in this area because I had a lot of shame about sex coming into marriage, and I was afraid of being rejected sexually, and so I tended to not ask to be sexual with my wife, and I kept waiting for her to be ready, and I discovered I might have to wait a really long time. But then I was full of self-pity and resentment. I started keeping track on calendars, which is really not a very sexy thing to do. And I finally, I think, have begun over time getting more successful at just taking the initiative with her physically and trying to and realizing the fact that I'm more motivated is a gift that God has given our relationship. Instead of seeing it as I'm more motivated and you're ripping me off by not being available or not initiating with me so that I can be emotionally protected from initiating with you, I've just decided, I'm more motivated, and it's God's gift to our relationship. He motivated me so that I would take the lead in something. I'm embarrassing myself. So part of me faithfully loving, some people say, well, how often? That's totally the wrong question. You don't understand biblical sex if you ask a question like that. I think the better question is, are we acting like roommates? Are we giving each other the benefit of the doubt? Are we delighting in one another? If we're more like roommates, if we're passing in the hall, if we're more functional, we need to get in bed. We need to be together. More to say about that. Take the class if you're interested. And of course, you know, the Hebrew word for sex is yada, which means to know. What could be more intimate than knowing each other sexually? To know one another. You really have to totally drop your shields to have great sex. And that's deeply intimate. Well, all right. I'm going to stop there. These are the principles. Maybe it'll help forge some of your questions. At this point, Debbie and I are going to respond to any question you have, no matter how embarrassing. You want to have anything you want to say? Any rebuttals?
Now, a couple things came to mind that have the theme of, what's the title? Strengthening your marriage, strengthening your parenting. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think when you're in conflict, the issue of that you see yourself as a great sinner, it's important that, you know, your kids see your conflict, and they're probably nervous about the fact that you're in conflict. I think it really helps for them to also witness reconciliation. And so I think it's important for them to see you admit you're wrong and, you know, say that to your spouse in their presence, because it teaches them also that they're sinners and that's what they need to do. Not that they're going to necessarily until they're married. But and then also I thought of that same thing with the praising, you know, when you're as a wife toward a husband showing respect. I think it's important your kids witness that as well. So your daughters or even your sons can have a healthy marriage in the future, is that they're witnessing a healthy respect dynamic.
Questions? Comments?
I just wanted to comment that I know among my other married friends and myself that there are many women who pray during sex to help for greater intimacy through Christ and to get that busy woman mind on track.
Mm-hmm. Good to hear that.
Wow, all questions have been answered.
So with the self-righteousness, usually my tendency is to think temperamentally my husband would lean more towards that, but that's me. And we've found over the years I tend to actually be a little bit more self-righteous than he, different areas. But real early on in my parenting, a good friend observed some interactions that we had. And I'm so grateful that she spoke up, because one of them was, she said, you know, you really are good at being verbal. But maybe turn it more towards the positive. And I argued with her on that, but she was right. Mm-hmm. And a suggestion that she gave that I try to follow through on, but I'm not perfect. She's like, especially in front of your son, you know, thank you, Daddy, for going to work, or pray with him in the morning, just with gratitude about Daddy's work. You know, just the encouraging of positive flow towards the really hard work that his dad's doing to provide for our family. And it really struck me like, oh, yeah, you know, kind of I thought, oh, I'm just verbal, and maybe affirmation would become a little more my husband would say it's more, not normal, but my tendency to, I guess, affirm, which we've found through the years, and especially through input of good friends who observe us, a lot might fly out of my mouth, but I have to be really careful about the level of positive and negative, because mm-hmm. I can tend to be anxious and then go down this spiral of negativity. Mm-hmm. And so we have a really important role to play with each other, too. Had my friend not mentioned that to me, I don't know if I would have picked up on it, and I still don't pick up on it, but a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. You know, you triggered a thought in me that when our kids were real young, Debbie used to get them all jacked up about me coming home. I could hear her yelling in the house, positively yelling in the house, "Daddy's home." And, you know, and my kids would just come running out. And I mean, she taught enthusiasm, and she taught this affirmation really early on. Now, today I walk in, and, you know, I have an 11-year-old and a 17-year-old, and, you know, I have to chase everyone around to say hello to them because they're just in their own little worlds. But I think that was a great thing you did.
Here's my question, Lee. I'm just thinking through as you're teaching this, and this sounds like excellent advice, possibly for somebody who, say, is newly married or maybe not married too long ago, whatever. But I know I've been married 21 years, and I guess I'm trying to think how to ask the question. How do you not get into this rhythm where, you know, you've been married so long and you're into habits and the way you are? I guess what I'm saying is this would really stand out to me if I were a newlywed and say, wow, this is some great information. But being married as long as I have, it's like you get into just habits and methods and rhythms. And how do you not kind of plateau, and how do you get out of that rhythm? How do you say, well, we can go beyond where we're at? How can we get to the next level when you kind of get into a rut after so long? Does that question make sense? How do you continually make this new and applicable when you seem like you've been in it for a while?
You want to fire on that one? I think I've been married 26 years, and I find these principles really helpful today. So I do understand we get into rhythms and we get into habits. But at any moment, I can decide to turn to Christ and receive from him. I can decide to be honest about my failings with him and with my wife. I could decide to delight in her, even if I'm not in the habit of delighting in her. I can just decide I'm going to. And, you know, it's always embarrassing when I'm expressing a lot of delight in my wife and she looks at me like, what's got into you? You know, but it's the embarrassment of conviction. Like, clearly this is not normal that she's reacting this way. I need to make this more normal. I have to focus on me, and I have to constantly be reviewing. I have this little tetrahedron in my nightstand. I pull it out and look at it. Am I delighting in her? Am I intimate with her? Am I being honest about what I really think? Am I really helping her succeed spiritually? Am I trying to help her succeed? I brought this up several weeks ago, but I haven't gotten back to it since. So I feel like, yes, I think these things are great for newlyweds, but they're great for me. And it's just a matter of, am I practicing, and am I taking the responsibility to practice these things?
What? Hey, Lee. Real quick, what are some practical ways that you can apply these principles in terms of, do you guys have set date times and how often, and like, how was that different from when the kids were younger versus how they're older now? Can you give some suggestions about that?
We feel like we have to have a date time every week, and it is better if it's open-ended time. It can't always work out that way, but we try to have open-ended time, or at least a long enough period of time. And so it's changed over the years, but now that both kids are in school and I have really odd hours that stretch all over the place during the week, I take Monday mornings off. We're usually free Sunday nights, and so we try to catch up functionally. We don't always succeed, but we try to catch up functionally. Schedules, what's going on here, what's going on there, I have to do this, what about that? And thinking through the implications of our schedule, if not Sunday night, then the first thing Monday morning. It's certainly a predictable time that we can have sexual time together. Not that that's the only time that we can have sexual time together, but it's certainly a time that we can look forward to having sexual time together. So I know I've talked with a lot of couples and tried to get them to have a date night. And it's murder, and I don't understand why it's so hard to get people to commit to this. This is really important. It really matters. You need to make the time. You know, when your kids are younger, you need to hire a babysitter. I guess sitting at home, I feel like that's a tier three date, to sit at home when the kids are in bed. A tier two date might be going out and seeing a movie. It's not a great date. A great date is getting out and getting face to face. And over a period of time, there's not huge distractions where you can both have fun and have conversation. And there are better dates and there are worse dates, but there need to be weekly dates, in my opinion. Is that a practical question? Is that what you were getting at? Or?
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. To go back to kind of what that guy was saying over there, I was thinking about that, and it kind of goes back to what you were saying in the very beginning about Christ-centered and the fact that we're sinners. And I think that with marriage, I mean, I've been married almost 9 years, and I love my husband. I love him more than I did when I first met him, but my relationship is not perfect. And just like my relationship with God isn't perfect. And so there's always room for improvement. And, you know, I think that, I mean, and I've heard a lot of these things that you brought up today, but this is like a refresher mm-hmm. course for me to go ahead and, you know, gosh, I know I don't love my husband perfectly. I never will. Mm-hmm. But there's always room for improvement that's mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's good to have, you know, to be able to come to things like this, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, I could have looked at this and said, you know what, I've heard this before, mm-hmm. or I've heard many of these things before, mm-hmm. but hey, it's great for me to think about mm-hmm. it, and, you know, there are things that I can look into to improve in my mm-hmm. marriage, so.
So another piece of practical advice might be stay in the game. Keep reading, keep going to workshops, keep letting yourself be reminded. Be in relationships with mature people. As someone pointed out, you pointed out that a girlfriend told you, here the talker over here is talking. You pointed out how a girlfriend addressed what she saw in your marriage. I think you need to have enough relationships with people who are mature and honest that they can give you honest feedback about what they see as well. So, yeah, this is an ongoing thing. One thing I didn't mention about sex that may surprise you is that a high predictor of happiness in a child is if the couple reports a good sex life. Now, how does a kid know anything about your sex life? He knows because of how it affects you. He and she see something in the demeanor of the couple that they didn't see before sex, and they see after. So,
I was going to say one thing about that, too, like maybe even if our hearts after so much time have become calloused to attending to the marriage in these ways, you know, that you can take to Christ as well and mm-hmm. beg him, you know, to soften your heart that you would see this in a new way. And then practically too, you know, I think it's really important as far as getting time together that you get a weekend away once a year. You know, I'd heard this from Gottman, a marriage counselor, that, you know, that yearly getaways are super important. And I know that
can
be
without
the kids, and that can be scary, or to leave your kids with somebody for a weekend or at least one night, an overnight. But it's really worth it. It's really worth it when you see what it does to your relationship. And then he also mentions at least connecting 15 minutes a day. You know, sometimes if you have a really busy schedule, you know, you can't even get dinner together, but, you know, a phone call or whatever, some kind of connection and greetings and leavings, you know, he stresses how it's important that you pay attention to each other in those simple ways, like a kiss goodbye or a kiss hello, and it's kind of easy to forget that, those little things.
Thanks. That's good.
Thanks. I definitely tend to be one of those people that is more like, I'll love you if you're loving me. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that, actually, I grew up in the church, and I think part of it was like, if you don't have sex before you get married, you're going to have a great sex life. And if you save, if you marry a strong Christian guy, then you're going to have a great marriage. And so some of it is just there's sin in the world. And even if you marry a great guy, and even if you've done some things right, like I still have sin in my life that I bring into the marriage. But how, if you, like, what advice do you have for couples who feel like I've tried that, I've tried loving, and it's, they don't feel filled up by Christ maybe? Like, what would you, what advice do you have for that?
I realize I didn't have time to go into this much, but I would encourage you to read Keller's book, Counterfeit Gods, because I think the biggest threat to an intimate relationship is a loyalty to someone other than, something other than God. For a lot of people, the loyalty is to approval, or at least avoiding disapproval from others. Well, that can really be a damper on a good relationship if you're hungry for approval all the time, or you're fearful of being disapproved of all the time. For others, it's significance to make a difference in the world, and so you may tend to be out doing things all the time and have very little attention to the home because you want to make it some sort of a big splash. For others, it's control. You need to have control over everything, and that commitment makes it you a difficult person to have a relationship with. You know, for others, it may be pleasure. You know, this is a big day-to-day sin of mine, is a desire to be left alone and to just be able to indulge myself in some peace and quiet. And you know, a family is a huge threat to that goal. And I have to be willing to admit this is a false god that I have put before God. And because I put it before God, it's affecting my family. And so I think deep repentance of what Keller would call idols can go a long way to helping you advance in these areas of sin. You have a thought there?
No. I was just reflecting on what the people were saying. Those of us who've been, I haven't been married 20 years, but I've been married 11. And you get into like what you're saying, the whole roommate factor. And one thing that's been really helpful, the whole attacking the idols thing is really great, because I think one thing that we do when we internalize things like that is we start believing a lot of lies, mm-hmm. and seeing them as idols is really a big thing. And then mm-hmm. another thing is our small group has been doing the reading through the Nancy Lee DeMoss book, Choosing Gratitude, mm-hmm. and she has a challenge in there for women to not speak negatively about their husbands for 30 days, and we all kind of giggled, oh, you know, like, can that, is that really possible? But when you're presented with a challenge like that, it is really great, because you realize how much in your thought life, maybe you don't even express it all the time with your girlfriends. I think sometimes when we're around Christian women, we feel freedom to do that, and like we're not doing that when we're witnessing to others. But it's pervasive. Whenever you talk about it, and then too, when you're presented with that challenge, you realize how much in your own head. And so then when they come home from work, you've got like 10 negative things in your head. And so taking that to task has been a really good thing for me, because I didn't really realize that like I was ungrateful until I was presented with that challenge.
Did you, having tried to do this, did you have a sense that I need Christ more than I thought?
Exactly. Yeah. And then two, you're more aware of what to be grateful for. Mm-hmm. Like I was in a conversation with a woman who was expressing how difficult it is that her husband isn't a follower, that she's the Christian in the marriage and her husband, you know, he's a really great guy and she had positive things to say about him, but just the challenges of a marriage. And I was like, gosh, I'm not even grateful for the fact that he's a follower of God. Like, how easy is that to be grateful for, you know, like, and expressing that to him? Because, you know, a lot of churches, there aren't men there. There's a lot of women, and you know, and just being grateful that he is a man of God, and that's an easy thing to be grateful for. You know, like that's there in front of me and has been there our entire marriage. And so, just little things like that, like thinking, not that that's a little thing, but just thinking of those things that he has always been, and that expressing new gratitude for that, and then can build upon that. Because, like you said, those things that attracted you, you kind of forget, and then, you know, relishing on that can be really helpful.
Here.
Thanks for sharing that. That makes me think of a gal who just recently started coming to our home church and CT and our women's group. Just in the last handful of weeks, maybe our friend has been coming around. Her husband is not a believer, and their marriage is one hot mess. So if I were going to share some of this information with her, or if an opportunity came up and she had a great question, how does these same things apply if she's just starting her walk? You know, what information would be most helpful to take from this to apply to her marriage for her if her husband's not walking and not a believer and doesn't have these same principles and beliefs yet, you know, what do you suggest there?
You know, a verse comes to mind, only I forget where it is. Is it 1 Peter about winning them without a word? Yeah, 1 Peter. Yeah, it's in her chaste and pure behavior or something like that. So her changed heart and life will speak to him, will speak volumes. That's one thing that comes to mind. So I think in praying for him, I mean, for her having hope that God will impact, you know, he promises he draws all men to himself. I'm sure God's trying to draw him to himself through her. There's also a verse in Corinthians that talks about he sanctifies us, our family members through believing members. Am I saying that clearly? You know, if you're a Christian, God automatically sets apart your family and tries to draw them to himself. So she can bank on that promise, you know, and pray in that way. And I'm sure she'll have opportunities to speak with him at some point if she hasn't already.
Her kids were quoting some scriptures out of the Bible the other day to him, and he didn't have anything to say. They're getting the kids involved now, so that's good to hear.
I think this is a really important principle in general. All these principles aside, there's something that shoots through all of these four principles, and that is the fear of the Lord. Now, a lot of people say the fear of the Lord is being awestruck by God, and it's true, but it's much broader and deeper than that. It's the idea that you are so amazed at who he is that you stop focusing on you and focus on him. That you're so amazed at who he is that you stop being so loyal to you and start being loyal to him. And someone in a marriage who is full of this attention to and loyalty to God will transform that relationship. These principles will come out almost automatically. If your attention is on him and your confidence is in him, you'll find it easy to be grateful. You know, in the second psalm, the fear of the Lord comes up very strongly, and it says that blessed are those, that is, shalom is for those who make God their refuge, who serve him with fear, who rejoice with trembling, and who honor him, knowing that he disciplines. And so all three of these things, to serve and to rejoice and to honor, are all tied to fear of the Lord. And so part of gratitude is just rejoicing. And my gratitude primarily comes out of my thanking God, and then it just naturally spills out into my thanking my spouse. So I know that's a big, giant, chewy topic, but I think we really undervalue how important that the primary relationship is us and God. And someone over here.
Okay. Ruth and I have been dating seriously for about 50 years now. We met in church, got married about 48 years ago, and I'm still trying to understand her, but it's a lot of fun. And she is a very dynamic individual, but we spend a lot of time conversing and trying to understand one another. She points out a few of my shortcomings, which I wasn't even aware of sometimes. They nailed me yesterday. I couldn't find my cell phone, and she went right to it. That's kind of embarrassing. It was right in front of me. But, you know, there's so much.
At least it wasn't in your hand.
It wasn't as bad as the glasses on top of your head that you're looking for. But, you know, there are so many opportunities. When she goes to work, and she works 7 months out of the year for the Worthington school system as a coordinator. She started as a secretary with about five other gals. She types 120 words a minute and keeps track of things that no normal human being should be able to do, and I wish that she weren't quite so sharp sometimes. She remembers things that I have done or forgot to do a few times, but it's interesting when she comes home, we spend time talking about her day and what has transpired and everything. Even if we do it when we go to bed before she goes to sleep, it has to be done. That way, we're on the same page. And after she goes to sleep, I get up and play on the computer for a couple hours. But it's a fun relationship when you do share time together and learn more about one another. She is a little bit of a brat. She has been an only child and expects to get her way, and usually does. And I expected that when I married her, but, you know, it's been fun. And our daughter Debbie there, and another daughter, and their three daughters. I've got an estrogen group that keeps me pretty much in line. Thank you.
Well, we saw a lot of elements there, didn't we? There was praise and thanks and intimacy and critique. But, yeah, yep, part of a good marriage.
Hi, I'm married to a non-believer, and I was baptized this summer. And when they mention that someone is married to a non-believer, what to do, I find that putting Christ first has completely changed my marriage. And a year ago, I probably would have thought that my marriage was going to be over. And through the support of my home church and the honest women that were surrounding me, instead of being told, oh, he's bad, he's not a believer. And so I was told, love him like Christ loves you. And through that, I feel like I've been walking the talk, and it's completely changing my husband. And all I wanted is happiness in our home, but it's just putting Christ first. And I go to him with all my problems, not my husband, Christ. But I think that that's the most important part up there, is that I pray every day, that I understand my role as the wife, and that I have support from others who aren't. A few people said, you know, drop him, he's off, But the good people in my life that are really committed followers and Christians were like, do what Christ would do. And it's helped us completely and changed our family.
Yeah. Most people forge around themselves little failure support groups, and are surprised when things fail.
I don't know how many people read The Onion. Has anyone ever heard of that? It's this online newspaper. They do a lot of spoofs on stuff. Somebody sent me an article like 10 years ago that I've held on to because I thought it was so funny, and it was called Area Man Pretends to Care. And it was all about, they interviewed this guy who would come home from work, and he was like kind of giving his techniques for how he just like looks right through his wife. He goes, and every once in a while I just kind of nod my head or say, uh-huh, or, you know, and it's his way of, but the whole point of it is that they were basically making fun of how these people made it work by him just, you know, showing up and not showing up. And I know one of the things that is always a challenge for me, and maybe this is only a man problem, I don't know, but it's great to do date nights. It's great to do the weekends. It's great to do the 15 minutes a day. But if you're not there, it can actually be, if you're there but not there, it can actually be counterproductive. I remember one time we have two small kids. It's really hard to get away. we went out for her birthday, and I was completely not there. It hurt more than it helped. Mm-hmm. In my mind, I was doing a check. Oh, you know, we got a sitter for the kids. I'm going out for dinner with my wife. But it hurt. It didn't help. So I guess comment need to be there, but question, any advice for how we can make sure we're really engaging and not just checking things off a list?
Well, part of being honest is that when you realize you've checked out, to say, you know, I feel really embarrassed about this, and I'm sorry, but I think I've checked out. Let me reengage here. I'm sorry. I think you need to be honest.
Well, and I would bring it back again to Christ, that you have to pray. I mean, if you know, you can sense, you know, I'm somewhere else. I don't even really want to be here. Oh, my gosh, this is my wife, you know, the most special relationship in my life, and I don't care, then you take that to God and you say, I don't care. I don't care right now, and I need you to love me, you know, love her through me. You know, give me the capacity, give me the ability to love my wife right now and see him work.
Mm-hmm. That's a better answer.
And I think, but I think, too, you're more prone to loving your spouse if you have an ongoing relationship with God anyway, you know what I mean, in the morning, whenever it happens. But to be sure you're engaging, you're nurturing your relationship with God, reading the Bible in a regular way, you know, praying, being in fellowship with good friends who speak the truth to you. And I think that affects your marriage ultimately.
We have time for one more. If there's one more.
I've been married for many years. I don't even know how many. But my husband is this effervescent, wonderful guy. And it's so funny. He says the things that, you know, you think about liking when you first got married, that becomes really annoying when you're older. And it's so true, because lots of issues. But what we've had, I think marriage has been the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. And part of it is just what you're talking about, is I'm trying to suck things out of my husband that God never intended me to. God wants to fill me up. And I think as women, we're just trying to get our emotional needs met from our husbands, and it will never work. And God is really shown me that he wants to be my best friend, and he wants to be there always for me. And the second thing is me learning how to repent, because I'm right a lot of the time, but you're still wrong when you're right. And learning to say, you know, my self-righteous attitude or just my defensiveness or wanting to be right all the time is wrong. And having, I think as my relationship with God has increased, I've been more honest with him about my sin, and I try to do that really daily, is just repent and then eventually go back to Bob and say, yeah, I'm sorry. But mostly it's before God and learning. Mm-hmm. I think we don't have a category for just saying, God, I'm sorry I did it again. Mm-hmm. And thank you that I'm just going to try again.